title is Chaos In It, Weather Prediction and Chaos.
The title lies. What I'm going to be telling you about is our weather efforts. And I'm starting off here with a slide of, these are the people at Maryland who are working on this project with me, and these are the senior guys, and these are the students. And so it's a big effort. So I want you to understand that what you're seeing is not even a tip of an iceberg. And that was my last transparency. So should we just, you got it? We are also not building new models. So if you want to ask me, does our model include all the physics? No. And we aren't interested in improving the model for forecasting. What we're interested in doing is understanding the model and using it. So we decided at lunch, I think, that I should, for the purposes of this talk, be called dictator. See, pre-dictator, post-dictator, dictator. What is a dictator? Well, from this sense, prediction is telling you what's going to happen. Post-diction is telling you what happened. Our efforts are to tell you what the weather is now. Okay? Just remember that. That's the goal. Now, the weather model we use is a National Weather Service model in the United States, and it's a low-grade version. It's got a lower resolution. We have a couple computers. One has 50 processors and can churn away and run 50 copies of the code simultaneously. But the model we're talking about is a whole Earth model. And so you have about 200 grid points around this way. And since you're only going north to south, about 100 grid points this way. And 30 layers of the atmosphere. So for every grid point, you've got 30 layers of the atmosphere. And at each point, you have 6 variables, which I usually can't remember them all, but there's temperature, and there is vorticity, there is velocity, there's ozone. Ozone is important. In any case, that's getting close. And so the whole thing has about 3 million variables. So the space we are working in is basically R 10 to the 6th, more or less. And it's sort of like a Hannon map, in a sense, two-dimensional Hannon map, in that you take two numbers for the Hannon map and you plug them into the program and out come two new numbers, X and Y. But here, you have to plug in 3 million variables, and you get a 10-minute time step, and out come 3 million variables all over the world. If you are lacking one of your variables, you can't run the model. Just like you can't run the Hannon map if you only have one number instead of two. That's why it's important to be able to tell what the weather is now. Over the whole world. All these points. Okay. What's the temperature here? Suppose we are talking about Toronto being a grid point. It's representing a region, 200 kilometers by 200 kilometers, let's say. So you take a stick a thermometer outside. Does that tell you the average temperature over the region? Hardly. Furthermore, suppose we have the temperature outside and the velocity and the amount of ozone and whatever else you want. What is it 100 meters up? And what is it 200 meters up? And what is it 300 meters up? And what is it 400 meters up? And what's... You need all of these numbers. So our goal is to use nonlinear dynamics ideas in combination with Weather Service ideas, Weather Bureau ideas, to actually try to have an impact on this idea. Now, when we started this out a couple years ago, the ideas we were using were quite different from what people were actually doing, but in parallel, people have been developing some of these ideas. We think we're ahead, but a lot of the revolutionary ideas we developed were also revolutionarily developed by other people. So, by the way, for some reason I don't understand, the Weather Bureau people tell me that actually ground level measurements are not of use in weather prediction. That, I don't know, there's too much uncertainty about what you're actually measuring, I guess. But airlines make measurements, and they are constantly being, commercial airlines make measurements, and they're constantly being sent in. For a long time, satellite measurements were useless because you have a satellite up here with some kind of a, how's that? Nice smiley satellite. And it would be making a measurement here, but it would be an integrated measurement. And if they tried to deconvolute it and figure out what it was at each level, they just created more errors than anything. So what they're now doing is they're actually looking at the integrated flux, the amount of radiation coming out at various wavelengths, as a constraint on what the situation is. So let's talk about nonlinear dynamics for a bit. And imagine that this is the weather now, and it's a state in, I don't know, let's say 3 million dimensions. I'm not sure I should say that. Our model is in 3 million dimensions. I don't know what you want to say the natural weather is. But in any case, let's suppose it's in 3 million dimensions, and then 10 minutes later it's doing something over here, and then later on it's over here, and it's moving around in our 3 million dimensional space. And what we want to do is look at the weather states that are consistent with this. This is like shadowing theory, if you know anything about that. So we choose some ball here of states that are consistent with observations. Of course, we're not making observations at the 3 million points. But we're making some observations, and so this is telling us that's our set of initial data. And also, look, I mean, they've been doing this for years, and so they can use initializing. It isn't a problem. The problem is how to keep it running. So now you look at it a little bit later, like 6 hours later or so, and this thing may have stretched out into some ellipse. And then you take your data and say what's consistent with observations, and you discard these states out here. Right? Standard nonlinear dynamics. And this thing you follow some a bit longer and it's getting out like this, and you throw away the stuff further away. And over here it gets to be a very thin pancake after a period of time. And so here's a very thin pancake. And there's no reason why your true state should actually be on the inside the pancake. Now, nonlinear dynamics, hyperbolicity, says what's happening here is that we can picture this as moving from here to here, but it's basically contracting in a certain number of directions and expanding in others. And as long as, so if this is expanding in k dimensions, and this is contracting in R 3 million minus K. And as long as these angles stay kind of away from each other, you can keep this up. This is what Anosov and Bowen showed. that while this isn't on the pancake is going to be contracting, and it's going to be moving closer. The natural dynamics are to make it move closer to the true solution as you go on. And it's expanding, basically, this kind of process that I'm describing here is a reliable process if you have a uniformly hyperbolic system. Okay. However, there aren't many uniformly hyperbolic systems. I got another great talk on a taffy machine for making, actually it's for making noodles in China. It's a uniformly hyperbolic machine, but that's another talk. Now suppose you move into a regime of phase space where you pick up an extra unstable dimension. All of the states you've been following are now going to get separated and start moving apart. And this will, so then a little bit later, all your states are out here, and this is here, and we call this a glitch. You can imagine it's a bit hard to follow infinitely many solutions. We only have 70 processors. But what the National Weather Service has been doing, and that's one of the reasons we got involved in this, was because they were already interested in following multiple solutions. So this is called an ensemble of what, ensemble of what? Of trajectories, solutions. And you can look on the National Weather Service, and they were using the same model we're using, but they've upgraded it. But they will give you a bunch of solutions corresponding to the predictions for tomorrow or a week from now. And they've got all these different solutions out there, and they'll tell you what the different ones are. And in Europe, they're moving even more strongly towards ensembles of solutions, so that rather than trying to get a solution which is more accurate, they're looking at a cloud of solutions and looking forward. So now, what we actually do here is, you see, is if you're following this cloud of solutions, well, we have tested this method with up to 150 different solutions. And we can think of this cloud as 150 solutions. One aspect of this that complicates this is that while we solve for a bunch of solutions, let's call it 50 solutions, we then look at a region of the Earth, which is usually about 5 grid points by 5 grid points. And we try to get our ellipse for this 5 by 5 region. Now here I cannot be terribly clear, but in any case, we get an ellipse for this, then we move over by 1 grid point. So then we move over by 1 grid point or down by 1 grid point. So we look at this box, and again we get an ellipse of solutions. Okay, so we get 50 solutions here, 50 solutions. We have to pass them together to correspond. See, we've got to throw stuff away here. And so the step of throwing stuff away and trying to get a new collection of trajectories is done locally, and then we patch it together. So, when I talk about numbers of solutions, you have to understand that the numbers of solutions, the degrees of freedom in a region of about 1,000 kilometers by 1,000 kilometers is far lower than what we actually observe. So as we're following this, if we look at this in a 1,000 kilometer by 1,000 kilometer region, we can ask, what is our ellipse like? How big is the ellipse? How many degrees of freedom are the ellipse? Well, how many variables are there? Well, we'd have 5 by 5 grid points. We'd have 30 layers of the atmosphere times 6 variables. But in fact, when we actually look at our ellipse, which is something like an unstable manifold of a trajectory, when we look at our actual dimension of the ellipse, primarily it's a fairly low dimension, and the dimension might be perhaps 15. So the dimension is about 15. So the point is that by looking at our 15 solutions or so, or 30 solutions, we're looking at a relatively low dimensional space. And the actual weather is taking place in a much higher dimensional space. So this is an unstable dimension, unstable manifold of a trajectory. So we follow a trajectory. We look at its unstable manifold in the sense that I'm saying here. And that's basically what we're doing. Now, here's the basic idea. If we can get in one of these boxes, perhaps 15, 20, 30, 50, a small number of data points, if we can get the trajectories which are most in agreement with about 15 data points, instead of this kind of a number, what is this, 4,500. So we don't need 4,500 data points. Pieces of data. We need more like 15 in order to specify which of our solutions are valid. Let me tell you once again, what the step I'm talking about here is, well, let's suppose we don't know what the red dot is. We have an ellipse here, and we want to throw something away. So we use something like 15 data points to be able to tell which parts of this ellipse are no good. We don't actually see the pink point. We simply make measurements. Okay?
You're implicitly assuming that the sort of linearization is similar to the points on the sphere, so throwing away, saying, you know, focusing on the same 15-dimensional subspace. Good. Here, North America is still in the middle of Mongolia.
So you're asking, so we have, we define a type of definition of dimension. If you have a bunch of trajectories, you can get basically the axes of the singular values of this. And if we look at the singular values of this, add them up, square it, divided by the sum of the sigma I squares. This is a dimension. Brian Hunt came up with this. So I can ask, how much does the dimension vary? And Phil is quite right. The dimension varies quite a bit. This is actually how we got started in this, by finding that these dimensions are pretty low. And so if we look over the Earth, how much it varies, it might vary from 30 plus or minus 15. That would get most of the cases. But the basic idea is that now, instead of trying to extrapolate by finding some method of extrapolating to find out what the temperature is 500 meters up, instead of doing that, we are looking at a trajectory which is consistent with the available data. Previous methods have been to try to guess look at the column of the air going up, try to guess what's going on in that column of the air. So that's how what we are doing is different from what people were doing 5 years ago. And I might say that we got started with the Keck Foundation gave us $1 million to start this project. So now, one of the things I can tell you about the dimension is that in some places the weather is much more unstable than other places. And what happens is that when the weather is particularly unstable, we find that the dimension drops. So that while you have your ellipse, let's draw it as a sphere for the moment, but if it's particularly unstable in some directions, then for the purposes of calculating it, that'll make it very thin and line-like, and the dimension will be low. So we have then taken this as an indicator of where the measurement of the dimension is where it's particularly unstable. So now what we then do is, at this given step, we're going to truncate this. What we really have here is perhaps 50 different solutions in a high-dimensional space. Yes? Mixing. It's hard to talk about mixing in terms of these trajectories. Different possible futures. So, for example, you will, if you look at the weather maps, you will get a jet stream of line of some kind. And what they actually come up with, what they actually say, okay, well, let's look at the spots on the Earth. I'm not sure I have the numbers right, but for about 20,000 feet, you look, where is half the atmosphere above 20,000 feet? Exactly half is above 20,000 feet. That'll be a curve on the Earth, a couple curves. And they'll show you these curves on the weather maps. They're basically pressure curves. And now if we have 30 different solutions, you'll get 30 different curves. And when the weather is highly predictable, all the curves will lie together. And when it's unstable, we can sometimes get... So here is the Earth, and you get a jet stream curve, such as I'm talking about. And if the weather is very predictable in this given spot, all these curves will be close together. Whereas, over here, the curves might be much further apart, and here it's less predictable. The weather models are giving different things, and here the dimension is lower, typically. If you wait longer, then the dimension goes up. So this is basically our conception of weather prediction. We are able to take 1 million different pieces of data and incorporate it into giving us an updated state of the atmosphere in something like 6 minutes on the computer. This is an important number because people want this to be done quickly in order to make it feasible. You can't take a day to predict what the weather is today, see. So that it looks as though this is somewhat feasible. NASA is bringing online soon a satellite which is going to bring in orders of magnitude more satellite data than has previously been brought in. They will show you the light intensity, the heat intensity, over a large number of spectral bands. So you have lots of data, and they don't know how to use this data and update the Earth, whole Earth model. So that's basically what we're trying to do, what we're doing pretty well at. We've actually gotten this thing running for the whole Earth model, and time will tell us how long it's going to take, how well it's actually going to be done. We haven't actually used real Earth data, we've used the real Earth model. and in a couple of months we'll be using real Earth data. So that's it for me.